The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We have, as you know, across the station, we're part of an initiative called News Talk Goes Green. That's with thanks to SSC Airtricity. If you want to find out more about Generation Green Home Upgrade, you can go to ssceairtricity.com. We are doing it for a fortnight. It is covering everything from rewilding gardens through to insulating houses. And the expert on the former is our expert gardener, Brian Burke. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Anton. How are you?
Have you seen No Country for Old Men, the Daniel Day-Lewis one, There Will Be Blood?
There Will Be Blood, yeah.
Remember the end? Drainage, Eli. I want to talk to you about drainage.
Okay.
Obviously, listeners get in on this as well, but I have a personal question. I dug a load of sand into a lawn on your recommendation. It has gone through the winter and it looks like the kind of raised bog that the EU would make me stop digging, make me stop harvesting. How do I get the thing to drain? Is it French drains? Is there any way that you can improve drainage on a little crappy lawn?
Right. Well, I mean, it depends on the proportions of sand you put in there. So, like, soil, right? Think about the mineral component of soil, right? It's made up of three different types of particles. There's sand, silt, and clay, right? They're differentiated on the basis of size. Clay is the smallest particle. Silt is kind of your mid-range. And sand is your biggest particle, right? So the perfect proportions of those is 40% sand, 40% silt, and 20% clay. Now, that rarely happens naturally. That's what we call loam. That's beautiful, fertile, free-draining soil. Like I say, it rarely happens naturally. So typically, you would have to amend it. So I would say what happened was you had too much clay to begin with, and the proportion of sand that you introduced wasn't sufficient to kind of redress the balance.
Oh.
So I would say that's what's happening.
How deep do you need to dig if you're just trying to grow effectively lawn?
Right. Well, I mean, the magic with topsoil happens. It's the topsoil, what we call the topsoil horizon. Now, it's very localized based on the part of the country where you are. Some parts of the country only have 6-8 inches of topsoil. Other beautifully fertile parts of the country, the Golden Vale, parts of Westmeath, Meath, Kildare, have beautiful 2-4 foot depths of topsoil. It's very localized, right? But the magic happens for growth. The magic happens in the top 200 to 300 millimeters. So that's really
well,
much.
That's
all,
not so bad. That's not
that's
too much.
All you have to do. Typically, if you get down about a foot, a little bit more, and you amend that soil, you should be good because you're draining then typically into subsoil, where the pores are bigger, the drainage is better, the particle size is bigger. You're into weathered rocks and larger components.
We have texts. I should move off the issues that are personal to me. We have texts coming in, one saying, I have metal raised beds, plural, in which I grow lettuce, spring onions and other shallow rooting edibles. They are about 16 inches deep. The problem is that moss develops on the surface. Could I apply something to combat the moss that is not a danger to a food crop like lettuces and spring onions?
I mean, again, if you're talking about, you're talking about a very limited area there by the sound of that. It's a raised planter. So, I mean, is there any impediment to just removing the moss by hand? You know, I mean,
hassle, Brian. There has to be a way.
Hassle,
see, everybody just wants these things to not be a hassle. That's the main objective.
But I mean, if you're talking about a raised planter in a small area, removing a bit of moss by hand is not a hassle. I would try and keep that. That's what we call a cultural control. It's doing something that's removing a pest or a disease without chemical intervention. Just do it like that if you can, and avoid the chemicals, which are unnecessary, to my mind, in this situation.
What about the, what do you call them? A geotextile membrane. What about one of those, put little holes in it, stick your lettuce through that, and then you've got a cover?
You have got a cover. Now, the geotextile is fine. It depends on whether you go with the woven or the spun version of it, right? The woven is the heavier kind of civil engineering material. It's called Mypex or Teram, to give it its kind of trade names. That's not such a great job where there's dense planting, because it tends to interrupt the kind of wetting and drying cycle of the soil. And it tends to get tangled in anything that has a fibrous root. So I would avoid it if possible. Again, if you're talking about a raised planter, you're not talking about a massive expansive area. It sounds to me like it's going to be fairly easy to manage that by hand.
Text asking, what are the best native plants to introduce for rewilding a small garden? Now, before you answer this, can I ask a general question about rewilding?
Yes.
Does rewilding just mean letting it turn to complete chaos? Or is there ever any plan?
Okay, well, I suppose the strict definition of rewilding is standing back and letting nature do its thing, right? The classic example of rewilding, much publicised over the past couple of years, was a guy called Owen Dalton down in West Cork. He wrote a great book called The Native Irish Atlantic Rainforest. So he acquired about 70 acres of land down in West Cork. He put up a stock-proof fence, which kept the browsing herbivores off his land, the deer, in other words. and he just stood back and watched it redevelop into a temperate Atlantic rainforest, which is what the landscape in Ireland would revert to if we all just stepped off the island for about 100 years. You know, back in a few centuries ago, 80% of the island was forest. Anything that's pre-1660 is considered ancient woodland. We've only about 0.5% of the island is now still covered with ancient woodland. So we've lost a huge amount of it.
And we lost it largely by hacking it down. I mean, the burn was man-created.
Absolutely. It was all cleared for agriculture, yeah, to grow food. But that's what the island would revert to if it was let. So rewilding, the strict definition of rewilding is you just stand back and let nature do
its thing. Well, a text says, I live in Louth. There's a lot of, quotes, rewilding signs in areas. It often looks like an excuse for bad gardening.
Ah, come here. I mean, we have to embrace a bit of scruffiness. I mean, like, we're in the middle of a biodiversity crisis. We're in the middle of an ecological crisis, right? We all know, the dogs in the street know, that the simplest way to restore the balance is to let nature reassert itself.
But I put it to you that I could either say, look, I'll leave that alone and it'll turn to muck and a bee will like it. Or I could choose what the bee will get. I can give it a petunia. I can give it a geranium. I can put them in a nice orderly way that blooms at certain times of the year. And the bee is equally happy.
Absolutely. No, you're right. There is regenerate. And again, we should make a distinction here between rewilding and just planting for pollinators or planting for ecology. Strict definition of rewilding is large scale areas to just let nature reassert itself, do its thing independently, autonomously. We stand back, we do nothing, right? Let native ecosystems reestablish themselves. When we talk about regenerative ecology in smaller settings, in suburban settings, in smaller gardens, we're talking about kind of gently nudging nature in the right direction. So you're right. We can introduce things like native pollinating plants, even things like wild thyme, digitalis, knapweed, scabiose, even heathers, things like this that we can reintroduce into smaller settings. They're native. There's this thing called co-evolution. So any native plants have co-evolved with native indigenous species of, you know, fauna species like insects are at the animal kingdom. If you look at, you know, your mammals, your amphibians, your reptiles, your birds, your fish, anything that's native co-evolved with native floral species. So there's a symbiosis there. If we can plant native species, our native indigenous animal kingdom know exactly how to deal with those and how to work with them and how to pollinate from them.
So give us the example lists that you had there. What did you have just for this person who said best native plants? What are the
Native kind of herbaceous plants would be things like wild thyme, knapweed, red clover, red and white clover, meadow sweet, purple loosestrife, bird's foot trefoil, oxeye daisy, scabiose, lesser celandine, the list goes on. And then native shrubs. Native shrubs are important as well. So things like holly, hazel, privet, spindle, there's a native strawberry, arbutus, broom, gorse, bramble, honeysuckle, native trees.
Do they matter? Because I always
birch.
Had the sense that when we're talking about rewilding and we're talking about supporting pollinators, that we are looking for things that are mostly sort of floral and covered in blooms. And a privet doesn't strike me as that, is it?
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. But some of them will carry a berry. So it's something like a rowan, right? Or a hawthorn is an even better example. Hawthorn is like a win-win when it comes to ecology and pollinators because it produces a flower early in the year and it will provide sustenance for the flying insects and our flying friends. And then at the end of the year, it'll produce a berry, which provides food for birds. So you get a kind of double whammy at either end of the season. So you get sustenance in spring and then you get bird food at the end of the year. Rowan is similar. Rowan produces a berry at the end of the year. Also the spindle. The Euonymus europaeus is the botanical
name for it.
Now you're
just showing off.
Like that produces a berry that again is poisonous to humans, but birds love it. So this is sustenance. These species are components of hedgerow, native hedgerow, and native hedgerow in an Irish context is very important because we're so bereft of native woodland. So as a wildlife corridor and as an ecosystem, hedgerow is very important. So we should be doing more to protect it.
Text saying, I have a small plot, it's all mixed veg and it's predominantly clay. How much sand can I dig in to help drainage? Well, this goes back to your proportions that you said earlier on, wasn't it?
Exactly. Now, again, it's very difficult to measure these outside of laboratory conditions, to measure the exact proportions. But again, you're looking for that proportion I mentioned, about 40% sand particles, 40% kind of mid-range particles, and then 20% clay. You need clay to hold on to some water so that it's not too free draining. but the 20% proportion is the ideal, it's the sweet spot.
And is there any so non-lab way to tell? I mean, is there anything like a slump test on concrete? Can you take a pint of soil and see what it does?
Yeah, well, again, when you're used to handling soil, you can tell an awful lot of the texture and components and composition of soil just by handling it. If you pick up a handful of soil that's moist, you squish it around between the two palms of your hands. If it leaves a mucky residue, chances are it's got too much clay. If it crumbles away and leaves your hand relatively clean, chances are it's loamy and the proportions are pretty good.
One saying, I've got a tiny backyard in Limerick that's more concrete than green. Any ideas on how to turn it into a green retreat without digging up everything?
More concrete than green, green retreat without digging up everything. Raised elements, raised planters. So again, timber, your metal, your precast concrete, your pressure treated timber, railway sleepers, things like that. Beauty of those is you can control the soil. You can control the components of the soil that you put into those because you're empowered. You can control the compost, the loam, the organic material, all of that stuff. And you can tailor it to suit what you're going to grow.
Oh, so when you start off, you can get the proportions exactly to what is the perfect soil as you set them up.
This is the real beauty of gardening and raised planters. You have great control over the growing media, as we call it.
Is there any issue with using old railway sleepers? Does the pressure treatment or creosote or anything like that cause problems?
It becomes inert after a while. They're typically so old that the active ingredient becomes inert once it reaches a stage of maturity. Like there are available on the market to buy for gardening purposes because they've reached their end of life as a railway product. So they're inert at that point.
Brian, a quick one just before I let you go. A text asking, we've done away with the kind of high carbon... any advice that are tough enough to survive footballs, pets and running around in the backyard? Give us two quick
plants, Brazilian plants, an evergreen hedging plant called L.A. Agnes and a native flowering shrub called hawthorn or white thorn. Tough as old boots.
Best in the world, Brian. Thank you so much. That is Brian Burke.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.